Post Harlan Mono Logics. Number 00090. Recorded on July 14, 2025. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Texas Red, Part 3, Chapter 90.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88. This monologue is continued from the previous episode, Chapter 00089, Texas Red, Part 2. And now, the conclusion of the Texas Red series.
So, dancing between the raindrops here, all of a sudden, man, it's been a wet July, very unusual. But anyway, keeping in keeping with the theme of Texas Red, right? Red things in Texas, red things about Texas. Mentioned Willie Nelson, and I was talking about the album Red-Headed Stranger, right? Red-Headed Stranger. The album came out in 1975. It was recorded in Garland, Texas at Autumn Sound Studios, which some version of still exists, apparently. The album itself, very minimalist in composition, having only a guitar, piano, and drums on it, right? Really, really plain. And that's the charm of it, right? Just simplicity. It's about the words. It's about the delivery. It's about creating a bare-bones ambiance akin to the Old West, right? The Old West. So where you got the piano, you kind of got like a bouncy saloon, old saloon type of piano going, and the guitar is Willie Nelson's Trigger guitar. It's a nylon string, classical style guitar, so you got that Spanish sound and his style of play, which is, you know, very southwestern, you know, kind of a Texas slash Mexican Tex-Mex thing, you know. And then the drums are just very sparse. I mean, really, it's not like a full kit. It's the little taps here, little touches there, kind of just structure and time, you know. Again, minimalistic, right? And you put all that together in 1975, and somehow, some way, you end up with a country album that scores multi-platinum sales, right? And I believe it was the first solo country artist to achieve that, and the second country album to achieve that. The other one being the Wanted Outlaws album, which Willie was actually on himself as well, with Waylon and Tom Paul Glazer, Waylon's wife, right? So it wasn't a band of these people per se. There was just songs by these people, a collection put together that broke through the ceiling of country music sales. And it was right around the same time. So you had the one, and then you had the next. So you're talking about the pinnacle of Willie Nelson's career right around 1975. And, you know, the thing is, he didn't really write most of the songs on that album, you know. He's known in Nashville from the early 60s as a great songwriter with a large catalog of hit songs, of course, performed like mostly by Patsy Cline, but others also, and, you know, covers of covers of covers all through the years. Really great songs, but on Willie Nelson's greatest album, he didn't write most of it. In fact, the big hit single from that, and possibly his most identifiable song, subject to taste, of course, you know, there's also On the Road Again, Whiskey River. He's got some songs, you know, that are identifiable as Willie Nelson songs. But Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, especially here in Texas, I would say that is probably the principal Willie Nelson song. And he didn't even write that. Right? He didn't write that. Written by some guy named Fred Rose back in 1946 and released by Roy Acuff. Again, I just mentioned Nashville. He was the Grand Ole Opry dude, the MC, but he was also a musician in his own right, singer, guitarist, and really good. He did this song in 47. Hank Williams covered that in 1951, the one and only, the great Hank Williams Sr., right? And then many others, before Willie came around to it there in 75, others covered that song. Ferlin Husky, Slim Whitman, Hank Snow, even Conway Twitty, and some other ones on top of all that, right? For me, though, the greatest song on that album, and one of the greatest country songs ever made, country western, really, it was perfect. It was the song that really captured the intent of the entire album, right? It's called Can I Sleep in Your Arms, and guess what? Willie didn't write that one either. Written by Hank Cochran, and it was 1973, so it was written right before it was recorded and released. But before Willie got to it, country sensation singer-woman Jeannie Seely released it in 1973 to some moderate success, right? But that's a great song. It's a great song. And it really kept, like, the Redhead Stranger is a thematic album. It's a, you know, it's a concept album. It tells a story. And I always found it kind of difficult to really put the story together based on the lyrics. A lot of these concept albums historically end up being a double album because it just takes that much space to really tell a complete tale. And this one may have been. I don't recall because I have it on CD. There's a lot of songs, but they're really short. And I don't know if it's just a 45-minute collection of music or is it closer to 90. I don't really know. So, but in any event, you know, I've never really been able to put the entire story together. Until, right, until. Well, I'll get to the until. What I was going to say is it was made into a movie eventually, right? And then the movie made it make sense. Before I get talking about that movie, though, I got to mention this album, right? All-time albums, Rolling Stone, which is oriented towards rock music. Rolling Stone magazine. All-time albums, Redheaded Stranger actually appears on that list at number 143, right? It's kind of surprising. But on country charts, for example, CMT, television station, Country Music Television, I think that's Nashville also. I think I've been in the shadow of that building, but not inside, downtown in Nashville. 40 greatest country albums of all time, CMT puts it at, drum roll please, number one. So it's that kind of album as far as country people are concerned. Right now, I mentioned about a movie. 1986, 10, 11 years later, they made a movie based on the album. And the album was based on some story that Willie put together in his head, apparently, using all these other country songs. And the movie starred Willie Nelson, right? He was the, he played the preacher. I'm not getting into the whole story and the whole plot, really. But the main character was a preacher. And one of the principal secondary characters was the preacher's wife. They came out of Philadelphia, and they went out to take over a church that was failing, or a church that had its pastor leaving out in Montana, right? So that's where you start to get into that Western, you know, old-timey, old Western feel of a story. It was kind of turn of the century. It was, I think, late 1800s, but up there you know, Montana, it was even, you know, further back culturally than anywhere back east. And like I said, back east, they came out of Philadelphia. The woman was a hussy. The woman was played by Morgan Fairchild, name that might be familiar to her. She was pretty popular in the 80s. And she actually appeared on a episode of My Name is Earl, which I talked about at length a few episodes back, right? So even more recently, whether or not she's still alive, I can't say. Kind of indifferent, you know, it's a Hollywood thing. I don't know all too much about all that, but I kind of vaguely remember her from the 80s in general, but I couldn't tell you a movie that she was in or a TV show or anything. I don't really know. Anyways, it was her, and she was famous back then, but she had an adulterous affair, cheating on her preacher husband, Willie Nelson, and her little side job there, her sidekick, got shot down by Willie, right? They got killed, and that's kind of like the heart of the plot of the story, everything that goes with that, and it's all built around this town, and the town was being tyrannized by the rich rancher and his family and the corrupt system and power that he exuded over the sheriff. A typical Western kind of theme, right? You had the tyranny, the romance, the broken heart. You had some drifting going on. And then he comes up to this stranger's house, which happened to be a widowed woman with her only child, a son. And he got taken in by them. Momentarily for a little while. Looked like he was going to settle in and nest up. They had a little affair going on. And then he was convinced to leave and go back to that town to try to settle the score with the tyrannical rich dude, right? It's a good story. It turns out to be a very good story. Worth watching. Accessible. I caught it on YouTube as a movie, possibly even for free to watch with ads, something like that, or am I paid for it? I don't know. But it was good. In fact, it was a keeper. If I could find it somewhere on DVD, I'd probably buy it and just throw it in my collection. It's the kind of movie you could watch a few times over, no problem. Break it out every year or two. It's good. And again, it puts you in that place. And that's it's kind of what I like about certain music and certain Westerns. Well, you know, all movies, all books, all stories, all music, they'll pretty much draw a picture for you and put you in a certain place. And some people are really good at putting you in the place they intend to put you into, while the rest of them, it'll default to a place that you relate to. You know, somebody makes a song and you hear it 5 years later, 10 years later, 30 years later, 50 years later, and it puts you back to a place in time that does not reflect the song itself, but actually your place, your personal place in time where you were when you first heard that song or when that song first clicked in your psyche, right? So anyway, so it's a really, the Redheaded Stranger, this album has has got that Old West feel, which a person like me likes. I like to get thrown back to that place in time. It's a open landscape, you know what I mean? It's just a wide open world. Rules are kind of few and far between. They're very loose and loosely enforced. It's a lot of honor and it's a lot of dishonor, a lot of thievery, right? The stories end up being, a good guy, a hero going in and dealing with corruption, tyrants, bandits, and trying to cut out a decent place for good people to settle and make a good life. You know, it's just always a great backdrop for a story. There's a simplicity to it, right? When you got the wide open, you know, the high plains and the big skies, or you go out into the desert southwest and you got, you know, just a wide open desert as a backdrop, it, like the music in this on this album, is sparse, right? Leaves a lot of room for your own thoughts and imagination. It's not so cluttered. And then when you throw characters, you know, the stage of a desert or the stage of the Great Plains, High Plains, again, being sparse, the characters that you throw on it become the focal point. It's the only action. Your mind, your thoughts, your focus is not scattered like it would be, say, Fifth Avenue in Manhattan heading up towards Central Park, where there's so many things flying around, you know, to distract you, to take your mind off of the focus of a dialogue that may be going on between two people, for example, right? So the Old West makes a great backdrop, right? And the feeling that it gives me is a sense of freedom, independence, which juxtaposes with this cramped reality that's closing in on me as every day goes by, right? That's what I perceive living in DFW now. So it serves as a viable escape for me, you know, when you need to escape through song or through theater. An Old West backdrop really does it for me. And like I said, the music, you know, it had the old saloon piano, so it really brought up that period of time, the kind of, you know, what you would call pop music back then was sheet music busted out on a piano played in a bar tavern that people drinking beer would sing along to. That was the music of the time, right? So it's reflected in the choice of instrumentation used on the album. And it, again, effectively portrays the Old West backdrop. Like I said before, as well as the Spanish-style guitar and just a very sparse structural type of light drums, keeping the time, holding things together where necessary. In the background, not pronounced, right? So the music, it ends up, you know, creating this backdrop that is very sparse. The music itself, like I was starting to allude to before, it's very airy. You know, you got a lot of room to think. The words are not complex. The words are not drug-induced. They're telling a story, a simple story from a common perspective. The pace is very slow and laid back, like you'd imagine with Willie Nelson, right? And it's easy to absorb, and there's a lot of room for your imagination to run between verses, between sections of songs. It doesn't overwhelm you, you know what I mean to say? The music doesn't come up, punch you in the face, and steamroll you like thrash metal would, right? It's not a beatdown. You can dance with it in your mind, and that's a good thing, as far as I'm concerned. In fact, when I make music, I have room to breathe in the music that I make. Not quite as much room as Willie has done with the Redheaded Stranger, but more so than you would commonly get. You know, not too busy, right? Not too busy that you can't keep your feet firmly on terra firma and resolve what's happening for yourself. You know, let your imagination run while completely tethered, you know? You can be an interactive fan of music that has that kind of room. And all that put together, it has a very authentic feel, you know? It really puts, like I said, some music puts you in a place that it wants to put you into. And does it effectively. Some artists are really good at that. I think of Tom Waits, who I spoke at some length on a episode or two way back in the way back. Tom Waits draws an audible picture. It puts you right there, and there's no mistake in it. The guy is tremendous at it. Willie has a way of doing that too, especially on Redheaded Stranger, right? So you get this authenticity that comes with it. When Willie Nelson plays Western, you know, country Western, Old West type of music, puts it together, tells the story, there's an authenticity to it. And compare that to something like, say, Bon Jovi, right? New Jersey guy, 80s, hairband, pseudo hairband music, did a song, Wanted Dead or Alive, right? And it's thematically Old West, but it's not authentic because he's a Jersey guy, right? And they were a rock and roll band and didn't grow up in such a place, didn't live the life, didn't love the life. And I'm not, if I had to take one Bon Jovi song with me from here to the end of the rainbow, that would be the song I take. I'm not saying it's bad, but as far as authentic, that's another thing, right? It's not authentic Old West. It's kind of like a cheap replicant. It has notes that kind of steer your mind to that sense, but the tale that John Bon Jovi tells in the song is not actually about the Old West. It's about being like a cowboy, right? Not being one, but being like one. Instead of a horse, you got a motorcycle. Instead of a six shooter, you got a six string guitar. And he's talking about what, you know, life on the road. Every band seems to have one or two songs about life on the road and what it's like. Bon Jovi apparently felt the need to express it in terms of being a cowboy. But it's not authentic. Redheaded Stranger is totally authentic. It feels like the real deal. It puts you in the actual place, you know. And again, not to bag on Bon Jovi in a song or anything like that. Just using that as something that comes quick to mind that serves an appropriate comparison to Willie Nelson's Redheaded Stranger in terms of disseminating and determining authenticity, right? And, you know, in keeping with the theme of old country western stuff and, you know, like getting in the music and everything, getting into like the spaghetti western, which predates Willie Nelson's album and obviously the movie, right? The spaghetti western was a thing of the 60s, right? Early 60s. It really brought to popular conscience through Clint Eastwood, right? Clint Eastwood in his younger days. He's in his 90s now and he's still alive and kicking, and I think he's even doing some stuff. But he's a lot of people's favorite actor, Clint Eastwood. But without going down that road, spaghetti western music itself, right? You got the movies, right? These were productions that were Italian, right? They were Italian productions, and then the backdrop that they would use, the filming locations they would use to create the backdrop of the American Old West was actually deserts and hill country out in Spain, right? So you have Italian production filming on the locations in Spain and incorporating American actors, and then a lot of Italian actors also. So your lead actors, your spoken parts would generally be American people, and then they would have Italian people playing secondary, tertiary, and background type of roles. And again, like I described the American Old West, the plains, the deserts, as being very sparse and as serving as a backdrop where you can really focus in on people without convoluting the scene, right? Focusing on dialogue, right? The spaghetti western, being a western, captured that. But it also brought in its own type of music. See, prior to the 60s, you watched the old westerns, the classic westerns from the golden era of Hollywood, from the silent era up until around 1960, the music was, how do you describe it? It was kind of fanfare, a lot of brass, orchestra, but very upbeat and loud, with a little boogie bounce for with saloon piano. It was not like we have it today. If somebody makes a Western today, you've kind of got that, a very particular feel that you would get from like a open tune Delta blues song with a slide, you know. It's like a really dirty, slow, bluesy. See, I call it desert music, and I call it desert music itself. There's a genre called country western. It's more the western side of the country western. Arizona, New Mexico, Old Mexico, out into like the Mojave. There's a sound that comes with that. And that sound evolved out of spaghetti westerns, of all things, right? It wasn't really an American approach to the music of a cowboy story. The Italians did their thing, and it was kind of wild and hard to describe, right? It's a distinct subgenre of film music, specifically. Now I'm reading to you. Primarily associated with the Italian-produced Western films in the 1960s and 70s, Here we go. Characterized by its eclectic blend of orchestral arrangements, electric guitars, mariachi influences, and often unconventional instrumentation to create a dramatic and atmospheric sonic landscape. All right. So that's a way to kind of describe the structure of it all, but to describe the sound of it, I don't have the words for it, right? It's its own thing, and you watch a spaghetti western and you listen to the music in the background. That's what it is. However that strikes you, and however you like to define it, however you put it into words, that's what it is. But it became influential to this day. That has replaced the golden era, the Hollywood golden era cowboy movie sound. And what we do now is an Americanized version of what the Italians were doing in the 60s. But I tried to describe it as best I can, and most of the elements were there, most of it. Now, the guy who's famous for that, right, he did those movies, a lot of spaghetti westerns, he did the music for them, including the Clint Eastwood stuff, you know. The Clint Eastwood corner of spaghetti westerns was The Good, The Bad, The Ugly, Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More. It was a trilogy. Now, parts of it included Lee Van Cleef, right? A guy who comes from where I come from up in Jersey. He's from Somerville, New Jersey. He grew up and he became the bad guy, you know, the villain, tough guy, the scary guy, the ominous presence in a lot of these spaghetti westerns. Great actor, and he appeared in some parts of with these Clint Eastwood movies, right? But the guy who wrote this song, created this style, his name was Ennio Morricone. He was born in 1928, died in 2020, so just recently, right as COVID was started, he came to an end. I didn't hear about that when it happened. He's an Italian composer, orchestrator, conductor, trumpeter, pianist who wrote music in a wide range of styles. So he wasn't just completely relegated to these spaghetti westerns. With more than 400 scores of cinema and television, as well as more than 100 classical works, Morricone is widely considered one of the most prolific and greatest film composers of all time, right? So that's a name. And you'd be familiar with some of his stuff if you heard it. Country Western music, like I brought up before in general, as it differs from the spaghetti Western stuff, is like a Southwestern variety of what you know as country. And it includes elements of Texas swing, what we know as red dirt music now, Tejano, mariachi, classical Spanish, something called New Mexico music, which I'm not familiar with, and it may be what I'm trying to allude to with the guitar, with the open tuning and the slide. It may be, and in my opinion, it even includes like a note of the surf rock. One came from the other, one begot the other, but there's that kind of twist. And in fact, you know, you think about, like I just mentioned, New Mexico music and the surf rock. There's a guy who I listened to, my wife and I went and gone and seen years ago, Junior Brown. He did the music for a TV series, a spinoff of Breaking Bad called Better Call Saul, right? So if you listen to the music involved with that, when it starts up, when it ends and finishes, it closes out, and just little tear away riffs that happen in the process of the drama during the course of the story, that's Junior Brown. And he exemplifies really all the country western, but he's got that whole western feel. In fact, he lives out in New Mexico, so like Santa Fe, Albuquerque, somewhere out there is where he centers out of. He's not from there originally. I think he's from Kentucky or something originally, if I'm not mistaken. But really, really good, really excellent player, great singer, great guitar player, great lap steel player. In fact, he invented a combination guitar / lap steel, double neck thing that he plays. He calls it a git steel. Could have probably done better with the name, but that's what he goes by. He plays in both, so he just switches off and on basically between two instruments on the fly, and he's just masterful at it. He's got a voice like Ray Price. He's got a lot of songs. There's humor to his songs. He does duets with his wife, who's a very good singer in her own right. It was a good show. It was a good show to go through. We got to meet him, shoot the shit with him, shake hands. Great dude, right? Great dude. starting to get on in years, you know, and we'd like to see him again. I keep an eye out for when he's coming through. So hopefully that comes up again. But probably the king of country western music, far as I'm concerned, is a guy who actually comes from out there. Right? Comes from Arizona. Now, let me just be clear before I walk away from defining and describing country western. Country is a combination of bluegrass that comes out of the Appalachians and then primarily the gospel music that comes from out of the Delta and the South in general. When you throw in a little bit of blues that come off the Delta and just a tinge of the rockabilly that happened from the same convergence of songs. This is all that happened in Tennessee. And that's why they call Tennessee, you know, the music state or the music capital of the country. In Tennessee, the way it lays out, and if you even look at their flag, they got a flag with three stars in a circle, right? And the three stars represent the three regions of Tennessee. And the three regions kind of have their own capital to them, right? At the eastern region, the capital is Knoxville. That's the bluegrass area. In the western region, the capital is Memphis, and that's where you get your rockabilly music, right? And then in the center of it, you got Nashville, and that's the country music. So Nashville being where it is, it borrows from Knoxville, and it borrows from Memphis, and that becomes country, right? Now, Memphis draws from the Delta blues and the rhythm and blues and the soul, the gospel music of the South, right? All that together starts to form up rockabilly music. So you take that rockabilly, you couple it with bluegrass from East Tennessee, from the Appalachians, and somewhere in the middle of that you get country music, right? So that's what your country music is made out of. It's an amalgamation of all these southern genres. But now you add to that western flavor, and the western flavor is going to be stuff that comes out of Texas and out through Arizona into California, right? So with that, you're going to get probably three principal elements that blend into the country music, right? One of them is going to be Texas swing. You got that swing beat, the 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, like that waltz kind of pace. That starts to get pulled into country music, which is usually at 2-4 or 4-4, right, in time. And then the instrumentation and the way scales are played on the guitar. Texas swing is actually very complex music. I can't even begin to play that stuff, right? But then you start to get Spanish influence from Mexico as you get further south and west. And that includes mariachi, which is something I brought up before. Now you start to think of like Johnny Cash with Ring of Fire, and they brought in those three trumpets, right? You get that mariachi feel because mariachi incorporates that. Mariachi uses different types of acoustic guitars, 5-string, 6-string, some other thing. They have different names. I was looking into getting one or two of them just to have a variance, but the sound really doesn't bring anything else into my music, not as much as the trumpets would, right? So they usually would have a bass, two or three versions of acoustic guitar, different guitars, and then a trumpet or two, and they play that Mexican mariachi music, which is derived from Spanish music. So then you also have the classical Spanish guitar, similar to what Willie Nelson does generally. So that brings more Western into it also. And then that would actually be the third element. So you got the classical Spanish, you've got the Texas swing, and you've got the mariachi. All those come together as additives into the existing country music out of Tennessee. Together you got country Western. Now, within country Western, you can kind of slide it off to the west and make it a lot more western than country, and then you could start to identify artists like that, like who I'm getting into now, for example, Marty Robbins, he's from Arizona originally, and a lot of his older catalog, especially when he starts getting into the late 50s early 60s, starts to reflect his love of the Old West, of cowboy themes, and then he's got an authenticity as somebody who grew up in the desert Southwest, right? And a great singer, great voice, excellent storyteller. I'll give you a little bio on him, right? Marty Robbins, you've heard him before. Martin David Robinson, that was his actual name by birth. He was born in 1925, died in 1982. Died way too young, as far as I'm concerned, right? Here, known professionally as Marty Robbins, was an American country and Western singer and songwriter. He was one of the most popular and successful singers of his genre for most of his nearly four-decade career, which spanned from the late 1940s to the early 1980s. He was also an early outlaw country pioneer, which registers with me, right? Born in Glendale, Arizona, Robbins taught himself guitar while serving in the Navy during World War II and subsequently drew fame performing in clubs in and around his hometown back in Arizona. 1952, he released his first number one country song called I'll Go Alone. 4 years later, he released his second number one hit called Singing the Blues. And 1 year later, he released two more number one hits, A White Sport Coat and The Story of My Life. 1959, this is what I was talking about before, right? He starts going into this really Western stretch of production. 1959, Robbins released his signature song called El Paso, for which he won a Grammy Award for Best Country and Western Recording. The song began Robbins' association with Western balladry, a style that became a staple of his career, like I said. And that year, the song El Paso came out on the album called Gunfighter Ballads and Trail Songs, the LP. And we had that in my house when I was a little kid, right? And I have it on DVD somewhere even to this day. Or CD, I should say, not DVD. I listened to that song from the time I was 2, 3, 4, you know, all through my early childhood. And my father had that. My father liked that kind of music. He liked Marty Robbins, he liked Johnny Cash, he liked Elvis, a couple of other things, but those were principally what he liked. Even as an immigrant coming over from Europe, he comes over here as a teenager and he falls right in with that kind of music, even though, you know, he went from Munich, Germany to Newark, New Jersey, and never had anything to do with anything like the Old West at all. Of course, as it appeals to me, it appeals to many people. It appeals to Bon Jovi, you know? New Jersey is not precluded from the appreciation of things Old West. In fact, they may appreciate it more over there because they just don't have it, you know? It's more romantic and more fantastical to people who don't come from there. But that's debatable, and that's not really part of what I'm talking about right now. But I grew up with that. I grew up, part of like the original music that I knew in my life was Marty Robbins singing cowboy ballads. And I remember, you know, as a kid growing up there, you get into all your rock and all that stuff and you get far, far away from country. Country seems hokey, you know. So many of us are more oriented towards urban things and modern cutting edge type of stuff. You're not looking to the past. You're looking to your own generation for your own kind of stuff, you know, where you fit in. I don't want to listen to my father's music when I'm a kid, you know. And we all go through that. But like I said, that's what I grew up with. And when I became an adult, that's what I went back to. That was familiar ground to me. But before that happened, I was so far removed from it that, you know, country western, all this stuff seemed really hokey to me. Laughable. It's hard. You know, like I'm trying to put myself in my shoes as I was in the days where Marty Robbins was laughable to me, because it ain't no more. It's very serious, you know. And I remember a time, right? I had a girlfriend, and this was in the late 90s, early 2000s, right? It might have been the year 1999, year 2000, probably one of those 2 years. And at that time, you know, the internet on the computers was still pretty new. It had been rolling for about 5 years. It was in its infancy. It was developing. It was, you know, you didn't have broadband connections. Everything took forever to download. You know, you click on a link on, hell, I don't even know if Google existed back then. We used to do America Online, Excite. I think there was Yahoo. dog pile. You know, there was all these search engines, InfoSeek, AltaVista, all these search engines back then that you never hear about now. You would do a search, you'd click on a link, and you'd have to wait 10 minutes for a page to load up. And that's not even an exaggeration. You would just click on it, and you'd go walk away, make some coffee, clean a room, do your laundry, come back, the page would load up, and then you could read what you saw, right? And it was during that time, this company named Napster, N-A-P-S-T-E-R, Napster came out, and they had developed a way of sharing music, right? So you would actually put a folder on your computer and link it into their network, and then people could go into your file, find your songs, and actually download them back to their computer, right? So it was just a for free Wild West music trade. It wasn't even a trade, it was just a music take. You know, you just made your stuff available and people would come and take it, and then you'd just go out and take theirs. And everybody would just build up these massive libraries of songs. Of course, there was no such thing as MP3 back then. You know, you were downloading WAV files, WAVs, and they would take forever. You'd click on one and come back in 2 or 3 hours and it would be on your computer finally, right? Now, I say all this because just to give you the backdrop of, you know, the life and times and history and how technology changes and everything like that. Napster ended up defunct because it was really just piracy. And it wasn't like bad intent or anything like that, but the ultimate price was that musicians were not getting paid for people possessing their music. Their recordings were just flying around for free on a whole new medium, right? Bands like Metallica, for one, made a really big stink about that. You know, it went to the highest level, the highest courts, all that stuff, and became a thing of the past after about maybe a good year, right? But for that time, for that short period of time, you could just go anywhere and get all kinds of music. And one weekend, me and this ex-girlfriend of mine, we did that, you know? We kept hearing about Napster, so we looked into it, and we figured out how to work it, and we just started downloading all these songs, you know? And I had gotten to the point where it's like, you know, there's a lot of songs that I used to listen to when I was a kid that would register with me to hear now, right? Now being 25 years ago. But I wouldn't want to spend money for them. Like, I wouldn't want to spend 10 bucks and go get Marty Robbins' Gunfighter Ballads album just to hear one song one time and reflect on it, you know? But for free on Napster, download it, right? And this girl never heard of Marty Robbins. She didn't know El Paso is a song that we downloaded, right? And we put it on, and it starts playing. Out in the West Texas town of El Paso, right? Really excellent song. But she starts laughing at it. Like, to her, it was that hokey and that funny and that silly. She found it laughable. I really didn't. I kind of wanted to hear it, you know? And I kind of wanted to hear more of it. And I started to download all these songs from my youth, all my father's music, you know? Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash, like I mentioned. A few Ray Price songs, right? He had Ray Price albums that came out, I guess, late 60s. It had a lot of Kris Kristofferson songs that were covered by Ray Price that were just great. And I got them now. I got them now. All this stuff I got now. And then some, right? But back then, I just started downloading all that. And you know, she thought it was so hokey. And I understood where it came from. But these particular songs didn't strike me as hokey because they were already instilled in me. You know, they were part of my psyche. They meant something to me. They meant more to me than I knew that they meant. And I didn't really find them laughable anymore, right? But she did. She did. You know, and on that album, right? It wasn't just El Paso, but all the songs were good. There was not a bad song on it. You know, that's an album worth having, right? Probably the principal country western. I mean, that, Redheaded Stranger. I would take the Marty Robbins over Redheaded Stranger all day. Personal taste, right? But there was also a song on it called Big Iron, right? Big Iron. It's been covered 100 times by all kinds of different people since then. Marty Robbins is well-loved and appreciated by country people, fans, and players alike. Huge. That's why he died so young. What was he, not even 50 or just around 50, something like that? But we could have got another 20, 30 years out of him. He's just incredible, right? It's incredible. But a Big Iron, right? There's a character in the song. Again, these are ballads, right? These are gunfighter ballads. And there's a ballad called Big Iron. And in the Big Iron story, there's a character named Texas Red. And he's a bad hombre from Texas. And he's out in Arizona drifting, you know, across the Southwest, right? The story goes like this. It follows the story of an Arizona Rangers duel with a 24-year-old outlaw named Texas Red, taking place in the town of Agua Fria. The townspeople predict the death of the Ranger. They figure Texas Red, right, who has already killed 20 men, he's going to come and he's going to kill this Arizona Ranger as well. But it didn't work out that way, right? Texas Red gets beaten in that duel by the speed of the Ranger and his titular Big Iron gun. See, Big Iron's the big 45 that he's wearing on his hip, right? Big Iron, Big Iron. Came to do some business with the Big Iron on his hip. Great. It's great music. It's ballads, right? They're not really hokey. There's stories in them, right? And like I was saying before, like talking about Willie's Redheaded Stranger album, how minimalistic it is, how airy it is, how much room there is for your mind, not only to grab hold of what's going on. It's not so loose that it's without structure. You can grab hold onto it, but while you do, you could still visualize what's going on, and you can actually contemplate the moral values of the story and how that applies to life even now, right? Human interaction, decisions that we make, the consequences that we pay. That's how I view stuff. And because of that perspective, I find value in things that maybe you don't value. Maybe you don't value country western. Maybe you couldn't give a shit about Willie Nelson or Marty Robbins or any of these people. But I like that. I like that backdrop. I like the way it's done. The sound, the sight, everything about it. In fact, you know, we picked up and we're playing video games. I mentioned in prior episodes that we bought, you know, we did some pawn shop hopping a couple of years ago. And one day, unexpectedly, we come home with a massive TV, you know, hanging on the wall now. 60-something inch TV on the wall, which you'd never figure from people that never watch TV. We don't. To this day, we don't watch TV. We play movies. We play, you know, we get DVDs and we watch what we want to see, and we'll watch them 10 times before we ever channel surf, because we don't have TV to channel surf too. We don't pay for that. We don't take part in it. We don't let our minds get infected by that crap, you know. But we also came out with a PlayStation video game console, or video console. That's what we watch the movies on too, so it's more than just a game console, but it is a game console. So we got that, and we got some old PlayStation 3 games to go with it. And I'd been playing through most of them, and I finally picked up and started playing one called Red Dead Redemption, which is something I had played around the time when it first came out. When I had some stepsons, they had it. I played it, never finished it, right? Things fell apart. I went different ways, forgot about the game. But we own it now. And I picked up and started from the beginning. That's Cowboy. That's Old West. It is literally Grand Theft Audio on horseback. Grand Theft Auto on horseback. Not audio. Auto. All right. Grand Theft Auto, if you're not familiar, is it's open world, third person, shoot 'em up game. You drive around, you steal cars, basically. You get chased by cops. They've got all these missions and a storyline that you go through. You're robbing money. Lots of blood and guts and murder and stuff like that. I like it. I think it's a great video game. They release them every so often. A few years, 5-10 years apart. And they got one supposedly in the works now that's going to come out this year or next year. But we were playing Grand Theft Auto 5 and 4. My wife never played that stuff before. And I mentioned it in the Earl episode. It goes back to the My Name is Earl. What the hell I call it? Earls of Wisdom, right? I spoke at length about Grand Theft Auto in there. And Red Dead Redemption is made by the same company, Rockstar Games. It's everything that Grand Theft Auto games are, but instead of it being urban in LA or New York or Miami, it is the Old West. So you're riding out in Old Texas, Old Mexico. You know, you got the desert, the plains. There's a little section of Rocky Mountains in it. It's just all Old West stuff, and you're literally cruising around a horseback. It is also around turn of the century, late 1800s, early 1900s, somewhere in there. And you're using all old weapons, you know, Colts. They even had 1911s in there. So it was probably around 1910, I think, the story took place, if I remember right. But it was really cool. And, you know, the graphics were amazing. They're 10 years old, but or more by now, 15. But they were amazing back then. You know, they're amazing now. And you could just walk around on a horse and just cruise and be content for like 20 minutes. It's not even about action. It's about the backdrop, right? So it's Grand Theft Auto on horseback in the old-timey West, Old West times, right? And it's actually the second of three in the Red Dead series. I didn't even know there was a first one. I heard there was a follow-up to this one, which would make it a third one. But that's built for a higher level console than we have, so it's not playable unless we upgrade at some point. The game took 5 years to develop. It was one of the most expensive productions ever made. And if you see the graphics, the landscape, the backdrop, everything involved with it, you'd understand why, right? Here's the backdrop. 1911, fictionalized version of the western United States and northern Mexico, including the Sonoran and Mojave Deserts, Texas, the Great Plains, Rocky Mountains, and some bayou type of landscapes. The plot, Red Dead Redemption, is set during the decline of the American frontier in the year 1911, follows this guy, John Marston, a former outlaw who, after his wife and son are taken hostage by the government in ransom for his services as a hired gun, sets out to bring three members of his former gang to justice. The narrative explores themes of the cycle of violence, masculinity, redemption, and the American dream. Right? Great. It was an excellent story, really, in a video game. A great story. And the music was insane. The music, spaghetti western, and how country, how the western genre of movie music evolved from there is completely evident in this video game, and that's why it's worth bringing up, right? It is Texas, it is red, in keeping with the theme of this series this month, but in keeping with the theme of the music and the progression, the, like I said, evolution of country western music, western movie music, this video game caught it and caught it perfectly. I talked about just getting on horseback and just walking around and the landscape and how you could just piss away 20 minutes just cruising, you know, just cruising around in this wide open world of the Old West. But the music and the sound effects that they got that go with it, perfect. Absolutely perfect. It's a very enjoyable game. I'd much rather play Red Dead Redemption than any of the Grand Theft Auto stuff, you know? If you're really, really pissed off and you really want to just tear things up and go on rampages and murdering and, well, get in a car with modern weapons is probably better for that. But if you just want to be a chilled, subdued dude who might have to eventually pop off and kill a couple of wolves or outlaws or something every here and there as they come at you, yeah, Red Dead Redemption was a great game. I would love to play the more recent release of it. And I talked about it with my wife, you know. We're considering actually getting a new console so we could at least I can expand it. She doesn't play the games very much. She'll play alongside of me, and we have a lot of fun. But I'll play it. I'll take a game, and I'll play it from start to beginning and just try to 100% everything, do everything in it, you know, as a pastime. I used to be like that when I was younger. I went through a very long period of my life when I wouldn't touch a video game. And it's different now. It's different now. But, man, what a great game. So, we've come this far. Let me just say, in conclusion, you know, everything that I've said in these three parts of this Texas Red sequence of audio monologue, life goes on, right? So life goes on. The stories evolve generation to generation. All we were given, all that we leave. Why do I say that? It's just everything that I've been speaking to in here, you know. There was old times and there's modern times. Old ways, there's modern ways. There's country landscapes and there's cityscapes. There's the rural, there's the urban. Time goes on, life goes on. And stories, they evolve generation to generation, but it's really the same story told in what? Different backdrops. And all we really got is what we were given, what we make out of it, and what we leave behind. And if you look at it in that very cold and materialistic sense, there's really no worth to it all. Like, I can't sit here and tell you how valuable, useful, enjoyable, say old ballads like Marty Robbins' Gunfighter ballads are to me if this world is only what this world appears to be. What I'm trying to say is there's got to be something more than this, right? This life has no purpose and meaning to it on its own tangible merit. You live, you labor, you get sick, you die, and if you're really good at anything along the way, you would just have stuff to leave behind to another generation of people who do the exact same thing. And then another generation does the exact same thing. So you inherit what you inherit, you leave what you leave, and your life in between is just busy as a bee doing your thing. To what? To what purpose? 70, 80 years here? Or less, just to propagate more generations? What does that even matter? What does that even matter? What does any of this matter? So where do we find purpose, right? Where do we find purpose? Where do we get bigger and better than that which we have to perceive around us? That's why I say, every man's got to turn to faith. Every man's got to find that something more. There has to be something more for any of this to be worthwhile. See, my faith brings so much color to all these aspects of pop culture that I describe here. Because there's a purpose to everything. There's a reason behind everything. There's a destination worth going to. And it makes everything here along the way stepping stones on an incredible journey instead of just spinning around in my own hole, turning in my own rut, going absolutely nowhere for no reason at all. I implore you to seek truth and find faith. See you next time.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Arlen Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.